Well, it is an appalling feeling, isn't it, going into an exam or a presentation when you know that you just have not made time to properly prepare. And so the butterflies mount as the moment of humiliation draws near. And then those desperate words from my school and university days, I remember them in the summer term, please turn over your papers. A very lonely moment. And actually, can I say, at that moment, I found myself bringing to mind, recalling the examinee's verse. Do you know it? Jeremiah 33, verse 3. The Lord says, call on me, and I will answer you, and tell you great and hidden things you do not know. Now, can I say, some of you may not be able to relate to that because you were sad and boring swats at school, but can I tell you, having got a third at university, I can. In fact, when I got my third, I said to my tutor, was I close to a 2-2? He said, no, Rico, it's a very solid third. So I knew then, that ordination to the Church of England was the only career option available, so here I am, I got ordained. And having got ordained, I thought, well, I'll never feel those butterflies again. Just to say you only work one day a week, it's a very relaxed life. It's lovely, I thought. But suddenly, I got these terrible nerves again, because in August, just as I arrived at here at All Souls as a curate, I was told that I had to prepare a couple for marriage. I didn't know anything about marriage. There was one girl I really liked, and I married her to someone else. It was a disaster. When I got to the bit in the service where you say, does anyone have any reason why they shouldn't be joined together, I nearly put my own hand up. I was longing to be there 2 foot from her at the altar. Trouble is, I was at mid-off, not square legs. So that was the end of that. So I really didn't know what was going on. And I remember going to the flat, and I pressed the buzzer, and I said as formally as I could, hello, it's the Reverend Rico Tice, come to do marriage preparation. And down the intercom, the guy said, we've got a bit of a problem. I said, what? He said, my fiancée's just gone into labour. I said, what, do you mean she's pregnant? He said, she's not just pregnant, she's having the baby now. Get a taxi. So I got a taxi, they came down the stairs, they went to hospital, they had the baby. That was my first marriage preparation, they had a baby. First one. It was not an uneventful birth, it's one I'll never forget. And I'd like to just draw you to mind here. Can you see, verses 6 and 7, another eventful birth. And most people would say, as they look at these two little verses, well, you've got Christmas. Can you see, as you look down there, verses 6 and 7 here in Luke's biography of Jesus. While they were there, the time came for the baby to be born. She gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in clothes and placed him in a manger because there was no guest room available for them. And actually, if you draw to mind any of the sort of religious Christmas cards you get this year, they'll focus on the content of those two small verses. And most people would say, look, if you want to get Christmas, you just have to get hold of those two verses. But here's the issue. Luke and the Bible writers, ladies and gentlemen, are not so much concerned with the events. They're important. Of course they are. But they're concerned with the meaning. Luke gives two tiny verses to the events. His agenda is, have you understood what it means? So can I ask you that, ladies and gentlemen? Do you understand the meaning of Christmas? Well, wonderfully, there's an exam for you, and it's in verse 10. Verse 10 is the exam, and it decides whether we've got the meaning or not. Have a look down, verse 10. Do you see? But the angels said to them, to the shepherds, do not be afraid, I bring you good news that will cause great joy for all the people. Now, can I say, you understand Christmas, indeed, you understand Christianity, if and only if it's the best news you ever heard in your life. So if Christ's coming at Christmas is not the best news you ever heard in your life, can I say you can be sure, you can be certain you've misunderstood it. Absolutely sure. One of my favourite places in London is the ice cream bar at Harrods, which probably explains why I'm such a fat old boy. And I was there recently on urgent pastoral business. Very important I went. And I was there trying to give someone counsel. There we were. And I picked up the Harrods Christmas catalogue. And this is what it says. Rejoice, Christmas is coming to Harrods, joyful and triumphant in a blaze of celestial splendor. This year, Harrods is brimming full of comfort and joy, overflowing with grandeur and gifts. Let the glory of Christmas ring out. Now, let me ask you, where are you? Are you with Harrods? So it's a sort of mixture of turkey, tinsel, tradition and trees, whatever. Or are you with Luke? It's the best news you've heard in your life. And I guess the next question is why? Why then is it such great news to be Christian at Christmas? Why is there such great joy? Have a look down. Verse 11 is the answer. Can we see? Here we go, verse 11. Today, In the town of David, a Savior has been born to you. He is the Messiah. Christians celebrate Christmas, ladies and gentlemen, because it marks the start of a great rescue operation. So can I ask, when you see the trees, when you see the lights, do you think, ah, it's about rescue? Do you fundamentally see rescue as being at the center of it? And can I say, it's not just rescue for us personally, though it is that. It's rescue for the world. It's a brutal world. But it's a promise of a whole new creation, a new world where some of you will have heard these words of hope at funerals. There's no mourning or crying or pain. The old order of things has passed away. It's all about being rescued. Now, as I say that, I think some people would say, as you're here, you'd say, you know, Rico, frankly, I can see if you're a clergyman and you've got a third, you do need rescue. But I frankly don't. In fact, in all modesty, you'd say, actually, Rico, I spend a lot of my time rescuing other people. You know, really, I do. I'm, you know, without meaning to be proud about it, I'm a little bit of the cornerstone. Can I say it is easy to deceive people? I've got the most beaten-up car in central London. It's a Ford Fiesta 1.1. And when I drive along, people often look disparagingly at me in my car, particularly out there on Portland Place as I'm going along. So when that happens, I quite often look across at them and do this. Actually, I have slightly concussed myself. Do you know these cans? They're crushable cans. So I've got the most beaten-up car in central London. It's this Ford Fiesta. And honestly, I stop at the lights. I look across. There's a Porsche alongside with someone very glamorous in it. They look contemptuously at me. I look back at them, crush this on my head. And as we drive off, I've won. So this saves me about 100,000 quid. Can I tell you, if you've got a dog collar on, it's marvellous. It is easy to deceive people. And as we see Christmas as something that we don't really need, we are deceived, and we're deceived into believing the great lie that we can live well and yet push God to the fringe of our lives. Now, we begin to see we need this need of rescue because even in our own lives, we start to see that there's a gap between the real and the ideal. One of my favorite publications of recent years is this Lance Armstrong autobiography. It's not about the bike. And we soon learned it wasn't about the bike. I love the Australian lending library that when the drug scandal broke, moved this from biography to fiction, this book. But there is a gap. When I was a schoolboy, I kept a diary. And in the diary, I did it because I wanted to be seen as a great guy. And yet in the diary, I'd write, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if there was world peace? I wouldn't lay aside the weapons of malice and sarcasm in my own self-defense. In my diary, I'd say it would be great if the starving were fed. But I'd ask my parents for a larger allowance. And as you can see, I would eat it. And there was this gap. But it begins that it's not just that we're cornered by our conscience. The gap grows because we begin to ask, well, how have we treated God? He gives us fun, friends, family, falling in love, food, fitness. He gives us the gift, but how have we treated him? And then we get to this point, ladies and gentlemen, and you can't airbrush this out of Christmas. We get to the point where we have to see that there comes a day when God, who longs to know us, who has given us souls, who longs to be in relationship with us, he says to us at the end of our lives, well, did we know each other? And also, what about your wrongdoing? Rico, what about your diary? Was it forgiven? And I can't airbrush that out, ladies and gentlemen. But then, as we see our wrongdoing and ask the question, who is going to pay? Suddenly we see in our first reading, the angels say to Joseph, you're to give him the name Jesus, because he'll save his people from their sins. So the moment this baby boy is born, there are thorns in the straw. The moment he's born, he's heading towards 33 years later, dying on Good Friday. As he's born, the name he's given is to save us from our wrongdoing. Can I ask you, what do you make of that? As he's born, he's the gift who'll save me from my wrongdoing. Look, I don't know how you do presents on Christmas morning, but I want to imagine you wake up on Christmas morning, and as you wake up on Christmas morning, you unwrap three presents from your family. First of all, there's Listerine. a lovely, there you are, you get it. And then you think, well, and it slightly destabilizes you. Then you get anti-dandruff shampoo, and then you get some deodorant. Can I tell you, even the most self-confident of us at this point would be feeling a bit destabilized. I'm being given these presents because there's a problem with breath, BO, whatever. That's why I'm given them. Dandruff. Well, why does God give me his son? It's because he is highlighting a massive spiritual problem that in God's world, I have not lived as I should. And the God who longs to know me says, but yes, Rico, what about your sin, your wrongdoing? And here is the present of my son who's come to die. Please unwrap it. Trust in what he's done. Let me draw to a close. I got married 8-9 years ago. This will make you sick. You're about to throw up, I think, as I say it. But I love my wife very much. She's incredibly patient. I love her because she loves our family. She loves her friends. She doesn't do ego. But let me tell you a major reason why I love her. Just after we got married, she started saying to me, darling, I'd like you to wear a bicycle helmet. And I hadn't worn a helmet in London cycling around for 14 years, and I wasn't about to start. So for 6 months, she said to me, I'd like you to wear a helmet. And week after week, I just laughed it off. And then she said to me, if you don't wear a helmet, you don't love me. Which is an interesting, I don't know how they do relations in your family. It's an interesting little sideline. So I got a helmet. If I didn't put it on, I didn't, so I was wearing the helmet. 3 months after that, I was cycling along Duke Street, and I turned into Wigmore Street. And as I turned into the street, it's 1 in 10 million, my front wheel went straight down a drain, a drainage drain. And I literally pitched straight over the top. And the only word I can use is torpedo. I torpedoed the pavement, absolutely smashed it. And this was the bicycle helmet that I was wearing. And it was just dismantled as I hit the floor. I have no doubt at all that I would have killed myself had I not been wearing a helmet. There is an artery here at the front of our skulls that actually puts blood round the head. And if it gets ruptured, you fill up with blood round here and you're dead in 20 minutes. So can I tell you, I love my wife for many reasons, but I keep this in my study to remind me of the fact she saved my life. And I find that helpful when I'm struggling with marriage. Very helpful. Can I tell you, when we come as Christians to Jesus coming at Christmas, you take this and you multiply it emotionally by 100. If you get what he has done to come to die to save you, you think how I think about my wife. Every day as I pick up my kids, it's a gift from her. She saved my life. With Jesus, you multiply that by 100 as he gives us eternity by coming to die. And we're saying, ladies and gentlemen, please unwrap it. Get the joy. It's quite overwhelming. But to see it, I've got to see my sin. I've got to see the judgment to come. I've got to see this amazing rescue that took place.